You are listening to a sermon by Jesse Nichol, recorded on Sunday, February 9th, 2025, at Poinker Intermennonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speakers are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgrmf.org.
Good morning, officially. It is very good to be back here with you. As Laura said, I have been at Point Grey a number of times, but that's stretching back over, I think the first time was probably in something like 2006 or something like that. So a handful of times over the years, but the last time was a number of years ago. We were all on computers then. It was in the middle of COVID when we were all remote. So I feel like it's been a while and I haven't been here in this space. So it's good to be here with you again. I know that typically, I guess answering that random question maybe takes the what would normally be the, you know, enticing story that a preacher would tell to gather you into the sermon. I didn't have one of those prepared. So maybe that's just fortunate that I got to answer some kind of random question, because really, I just want to dive right into the text. My heart is in Bible study, in exegetical work. And so I guess when I'm here, that's what you get. So I hope that's okay, that we turn straight to Ephesians chapter 2 and just get started. And maybe some of the stories will come a little bit later on. So in the second chapter of Paul's letter to the Ephesians, he describes in captivating, comprehensive, memorable fashion God's work of reconciliation and transformation that takes place in and through Jesus. So in the first half of this chapter, which is verses 1 to 10, Paul's attention is on reconciliation that takes place between human beings and God, which he describes in terms of transformation from death to life. So he writes in verses 1 and then 4 to 5, "You were dead through your transgressions and sins in which you once walked. But God, being rich in mercy, because of the abundant love with which he loved us, even when we were dead through our transgressions, made us alive together with the Messiah." I would imagine these are words that are familiar to many of us. God, who acted in accordance with God's own character, his mercy and grace and his steadfast and abounding love, has delivered us from slavery and death, offers us this salvation freely as a gift. And as a result of this, we are made alive by the Spirit. We are created in the Messiah, Jesus, in order to live out the good works that God has made for us as the bearers of his image. In verse 10. Friends, this is gospel. Yes, this is good news. This is right at the heart of what we think of when we use that word, gospel. But there is another aspect to this gospel, and it is one that many Christians, for whatever reason, seem to attend to far less often. And it is this other side of the gospel, of the good news, that is the focus of the second half of the chapter, verses 11 to 22. And in this half, the reconciliation in focus is that which takes place not between human beings and God, but between human beings and other human beings. And the transformation that takes place is not moving from death to life, but it is a transformation that takes place moving from being outsiders to insiders. So Paul writes in verse 13, "Now, in the Messiah Jesus, you, those who once were far away, have been brought near by the blood of the Messiah." In these verses, Paul articulates what he describes elsewhere as the mystery that once was hidden and now is made known in Jesus. Namely, that through Jesus, the suffering servant Messiah, God has brought to fulfillment the promise that God made all the way back to Abraham. The promise that through his descendants, all the nations of the earth would be blessed. So for Paul, the good news of what God has done through Jesus is not only that we have been delivered from sin and death, but also that that good news is for the whole world, for all people. God's plan to bring together all things in the Messiah has been put into effect. And the evidence of this is us, the worldwide church, the one new humanity. At the heart of this second half of Ephesians 2 are closely linked ideas, the closely linked ideas of reconciliation and peace. And these ideas, this comes through most clearly in the five verses that are at its core, which is the final text that we just heard read out to us, verses 14 through 18. If you have the text available in front of you, you will notice, I hope, even as you heard it read, that Paul places the concept of peace at the very center of his understanding of the gospel. He uses the word four times in just five verses to describe what he is trying to get across to his readers. First of all, in verse 14, he simply identifies Jesus as the one who, he says, is our peace. That is to say, Jesus, the crucified and resurrected Messiah, bears sole responsibility for creating the peace that now exists within the one new humanity. In his flesh, Paul says, in himself, Jesus disarmed that which once divided and created hostility, and he brought together into one what was once two. Thus, says Paul in verse 15, making peace. So that second use of the word, it results from this act of reconciliation that creates or that leads to unity, the joining together of what once had been separate. And finally, the basis of that unity, its foundation, is described in verse 16. Paul writes that in his body, on the cross, Jesus reconciled both groups to God. So what he's saying is that the salvation that he described in verses 1 to 10 is accomplished in the same way, which is Jesus' death on the cross. It is offered on the same basis, which is faith in Jesus, to everyone. And so Paul declares the peace that was at the heart of Jesus' ministry. And this is, very importantly, this is the peace that is shalom, right? This is big picture peace. This is not simple, we're not going to fight together anymore peace. This is reconciling peace, restorative peace, harmonious peace, the peace that comes with God's reign. This peace is a message for all to hear, whether one is near to God or far away from God. It is through Jesus that everyone may come to God by the one Spirit. I think it is important to see that what the apostle describes here, this is not an afterthought to the gospel that he describes in the first 10 verses of the chapter. This person-to-person reconciliation, this unity, is a critical component for Paul of what has been accomplished by God in and through Jesus. New Testament scholar Lynn Kohick writes, humanity created by this peace is another way of expressing by grace you have been saved. She goes on, simultaneously, the believer is forgiven and made new, reconciled to God and to enemy at one time. She is emphasizing that these two reconciliations are intertwined with one another. So Ephesians places peace at the heart of God's work in and through Jesus. Through the death of Jesus, peace was made. Shalom, peace. The peace that results from restoration, reconciliation. The peace that produces flourishing and abundant life. And that peace is now offered freely to all who will receive it. And all who do so are welcomed into this new covenant community through Jesus's blood. They are marked as God's children by the Spirit. They are, as Paul says, created new in the Messiah Jesus to walk by the Spirit as the new humanity. In Jesus, all that once divided has been destroyed. All envy, hostility, and division has no more place. Where there was estrangement, there is reconciliation. Where there was separation, there is unity. Where there was hostility, there is peace. When Paul will declare in another of his writings that God has given us the ministry of reconciliation, this is 2 Corinthians chapter 5. This is the outcome of God reconciling us to himself through the Messiah. But it isn't just us. Paul quickly clarifies in verse 19, that is, in the Messiah, God was reconciling the world to himself. And so it is for that reason that Paul declares, now going to 2 Corinthians 5:16, that he no longer regards anyone from a human point of view, for if anyone is in Christ, new creation. Those who are in Jesus are made new and united by the Spirit, and in this way, they embody the gospel of peace. Sisters and brothers, what Paul is saying here is that the good news, the gospel, is not just about being reconciled to God. I want to be clear there to say, when I say it is not just, I am not minimizing that, nor am I saying that's not, of course, that's at the core, that's at its heart. But it is not just that, it is also about reconciliation with one another. Jesus' death and resurrection somehow affects not only our forgiveness and freedom from sin. In doing that, it enables us to be connected to those from whom we were once divided in a way that had not been previously possible. So the outcome of God's work is not just internal. It's not something that just occurs in our hearts, so to speak. It is not something that just exists only between us and God. It is also external. It lives right here. It lives in the space between me and you. It lives in the space between you and the person you are sitting next to. It lives in our interactions, in our heart posture, in our mindset towards one another. The effect of the gospel is embodied. It is relational. Now, I would lose my New Testament exegesis card if I didn't mention something about historical context here, okay? So I got to make sure to cover that, because in the case of Ephesians 2, that means we need to recognize that the primary division that Paul is talking about here as having been overcome is that which had existed between Jews and Gentiles, yes? Jews and non-Jews. So the apostle does have at the front of his mind the fact that because God in Jesus had brought the old covenant to fulfillment and had established in his death and resurrection the new covenant, the Torah, the Mosaic law, no longer stands as a dividing wall between those who are in and out. Yes? Okay. So he is saying that now in Jesus, all, Jew or Gentile, Israel or Roman, right? All could be citizens. All could be members of God's household. All could be the dwelling of God's Spirit. And it's important to recognize that and to ground this observation in that historical contextualization. Now, most 21st century Christians, we don't typically have to struggle to come to terms with this idea. Yes, this is not most of the time a problem that we have, the idea that to truly be a part of the people of God requires, you know, someone to keep food laws or adhere to guidelines around ritual purity or, you know, circumcise your male children. We are not too caught up about those as boundary markers for being in and out in the church. Yes, I assume so. Most of us, okay. So, in other words, most Christians today, we do not associate belonging to Jesus with belonging to one specific ethnic group. Yes. Although, maybe speaking to a group of Mennonites, we might want to hear that a little bit more carefully. And that is not me passing judgment from outside. Yes, that's me speaking as a voice from within. Maybe we need to be careful sometimes about how much we associate, you know, being a Mennonite with having a certain last name or knowing what roll cooking are or something like that. But we won't go down that road. That's maybe a sermon for another day. The point is here, as I was saying, we are maybe not as caught up in divisions over ethnic identity as Paul's original audience. But that doesn't mean that this emphasis upon reconciliation and unity has nothing to say to us. Disagreement, disunity, and polarization are rampant in the world around us. They dominate the nightly news cycle. They characterize our political engagement. They impact our social interactions. Opinions have become more deeply entrenched. There is less distinction between the opinion a person holds and the person, him or herself. The lines that divide us from them have become more sharply defined with fewer shades of gray between black and white. There is less tolerance for anything other than unanimity on certain issues. There is more of a sense that if you're not for us, you're against us. And the result of this has tended to be an unwillingness to voice dissenting or even nuanced opinions, because we feel that if we do raise a voice that maybe goes against the kind of general perspective of whatever group we're a part of, we're going to be ostracized, right? We're going to be written off as one of those people. Constructive dialogue, it feels like a relic of a bygone era. It is as if compromise is a curse word. And our churches are lamentably not immune to any of this. Churches are, to state the obvious, made up of people who live in this world and are affected by it, both consciously and unconsciously. This is the context that we are embedded in. If we are honest with ourselves, I would suspect that few of us have to think too hard to come up with some aspect of our faith, something about what we think about what a Christian ought to believe, or how a Christian ought to live, or what causes a Christian ought to support, something that we deep down believe to be non-negotiable. Something that, if there is someone who thinks differently from us on that topic, it's gonna be a challenge for us to wholeheartedly be in community with him or her. I would guess that most of us can come up with one or two things. It's probably not that hard to come up with some characteristic of a person or a group of people that provokes within us a, shall we say, less than positive response. Yes? I'm not like those people. How could anyone believe that? How could anyone think that way? How could anyone buy that product? How could anyone support that politician? How could anyone go to that church? Now, all of this said, I want to be clear. I'm not here intending to pass judgment upon anyone that I do not also place upon myself. I'm also not here to offer a sociological analysis and dig into the origins of these divisions or prognosticate about their dangers. And I certainly don't have any simple solutions to any of them. Apologies. But nothing about this is easy, right? Nothing about it is simple when the things that we disagree about are far from trivial. We're not disagreeing over what brand of cereal we like to have for breakfast. These are things that are a lot weightier. They carry significance about how we live and exist in the world. And how do we remain in community? How do we continue to be co-body members with someone who holds opinions or engages in actions that we are strongly against? That's an extraordinarily difficult question, and it resists simplistic solutions. So while I may not be able to offer easy three-step problem-solving solutions here for us to leave church this morning with, as we turn towards our conclusion here, I can offer, I hope I can offer, a couple of reflections that arise from this text, these words of Paul in Ephesians 2. First of all, peace, reconciliation, and as a result, unity are, I think, at the heart of the identity of the church. As Paul's words make clear, the good news of God's work in and through Jesus is the good news of peace. Jesus has brought about this all-encompassing restorative peace ultimately through his death on the cross, through which all human beings have been reconciled to God. All who receive the gift of life through faith in Jesus are joined together by the Spirit to become part of the one body of the Messiah. That is the one new humanity. That is the church. That which unifies us is stronger than anything that once divided us or made us hostile to one another. We are a community that exists as a result of reconciliation that is not only vertical, but also horizontal. And these two reconciliations are intertwined and indeed inseparable from one another. To quote the New Testament scholar Michael Gorman, he writes this: a single act, Christ's death, both reconciles people to God and reconciles people to one another. This reinforces the inseparability of the two dimensions of reconciliation. There is no reconciliation with God without reconciliation with others. For this is what God in the cross was up to. End quote. There is no reconciliation with God without reconciliation with others. The former is the cause of the latter, and the outcome isn't negotiable. We are reconciled in and through Jesus. We are united in and through Jesus. Second, peace, reconciliation, And as a result, unity are also at the heart of the mission of the church. We must live out our identity as a reconciled community of the reconciled in order to play our part in God's eternal plan, God's mission to reconcile all things, including all people, to himself. The church is called to be a community that embodies the peace of the age to come. We must demonstrate by our life together that all those identity markers that hostile spiritual forces tell us ought to divide us cannot overcome the unity rooted in the peace made by Jesus. The one who is our head is greater and more powerful than anything that divides or turns us against one another. So when we are divided and disunified and hostile, when we undercut, when we snipe at, when we write off each other, we betray Jesus's victory and fail to borrow the words of Paul, walk worthy of our calling. Friends, we harm our witness. By living in reconciliation and unity, the diverse but reconciled new humanity that is the church manifests the truth and the power of the gospel it proclaims. And the church in this way contributes to God's reconciliation going forth in the world. One more time from Gorman. The church is both the witness to God's redemptive plan for the world and the primary means God has established for drawing a fractured, hostile, and violent world together. Reconciliation is not only what God has done for us, but also what God wants to do through us. So, in conclusion here, I want to encourage us to take our unity seriously. And perhaps a first step of that is recognizing that polarized thinking is not just out there, it is also in here. And I'm not, again, speaking just about this congregation. I may have been here a handful of times, but I don't know the relational dynamics here. I am speaking more broadly of the church as a whole. Division and disunity exists. And I think we need to be conscious of that. We need to address it. And we need to seek by God's Spirit ways to work at it. Too often in the history of the church, when disagreements happen, what ends up taking place is one group just ends up leaving and starting their own church. And maybe sometimes that's the best outcome in a lot of hurt and a lot of pain and a lot of destruction. But maybe sometimes we need to be a bit more conscious of what else we might do to embody the reconciliation that has been given to us. Secondly, if it is indeed true that a significant part of what God accomplished in and through Jesus' death on the cross is that the powers that sought to divide us have been defeated, that hostility itself, as Paul writes, has been put to death, then let us reflect on how that reality is embodied in our life as a community together. Let us challenge ourselves to consider how we could embody it more fully. And friends, let us be hopeful. The disunity and the polarization that permeates the world in which we live is lamentable and problematic for all kinds of reasons. But it has also created an opportunity, because the gospel tells us that in and through Jesus, God made peace. And by living in this peace, by being in community with people with whom, according to the norms of our culture, we would not be, by recognizing that unity does not mean unanimity, but that we are held together by something, or perhaps better to say, by someone that transcends any barrier that might stand between us, the church has the opportunity to embody God's reconciling power. Our unity is the evidence to the powers of hostility and hatred that we are no longer held in their grip. God's power, demonstrated in the resurrection, exaltation, and enthronement of Jesus, is now at work in and among us by the Spirit, and it is greater than any other. Hear the gospel. The good news of what God has done in Jesus is not only that God, because of his great love for us, has made us alive in Jesus, saving us by grace through faith. It is also that God has made peace. Jesus himself has become our peace. Jesus is its source. Jesus is its embodiment. Jesus is the one who puts it into effect. So let us live that out in our life together. Amen.